Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPW 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren. We're going to talk about a book that it grabs you by the throat and never lets go. Does that sound exciting?
It does.
Yeah, well, we've got the author of it here, and the book is called Kill All Your Darlings, and the author is David Bell. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to say that books are allowed to grab people by the throat and never let go, but authors are not.
Well, not and get caught.
It's a double standard that they have for the book and the author.
My book, my choice.
Right.
Anyway, well, so listen, it looks like you write these kinds of books that, I don't know, they're suspense, they sort of, they're kind of crime fiction, psychological thrillers. How do you put a book like this together? Like, do you actually get into a role of one of the characters and then kind of develop that around that character or something else?
I guess it usually starts with a situation. I'm trying to think of a situation that I can put a character in, and then that situation can get much worse for the character. Because I always say that writing is the endeavor where you can try your best to torment someone and make their life worse, and it's acceptable because that's what we do as authors. We put our characters in these situations and try to make it worse and worse for them until they figure something out. So usually it begins with that situation, just what would happen if this person was in this situation, and then where would it go from there? So in the case of this book, I was thinking, what if you were a college professor who had stolen a manuscript from a student who you thought was dead, and the student turns up very much alive right when the book is published, and where's it going to go from there?
Oh, well, then you kill the student.
Well, I mean, I teach at a university, so I have certainly had that thought before about wanting to kill students, but not for that reason. But no. Yes, I understand that impulse.
Yeah, but okay, so now you've got this situation set up. Very intriguing. So from there, who do you decide is going to be the teacher, and who do you decide is going to be, you know, the student? And I ask that because, you say that you teach as well. So there's sort of a connection there for you with one of the characters.
Yeah, obviously. So in this book, the protagonist is the college professor and the creative writing professor, and that's what I do for my day job. So there, that was the closest identification I've ever had to one of my protagonists, because in the past, I'm writing about characters who did not have my occupation, and I had to make up an occupation for them. And since I've never actually had a real job, that's always the hardest part of writing the book, is figuring out what do people do in the real world who have real jobs. So in this case, I didn't have to think about that because my protagonist was a writer and a college professor, which are two unreal jobs that I have. So that was a little easier for me. But the professor is the protagonist there. But there are two other point of view characters who are both students. Well, one is a former student and one is a current student. So I drew on my experience with my students to write about those characters as well.
Well, I wonder too, you're writing a lot of suspense crime, suspense thrillers where the protagonist is basically an ordinary person, as I guess opposed to being a detective or a PI or an agent. What attracts you to that type of character?
Yeah, I do write about ordinary people who have these extraordinary things happen to them. And I think that I do that because there are lots of books about those characters who are agents or former agents or cops or whatever. And I love so many of those books. But at a certain point, it's hard for me to relate to those characters because they know how to, like if you read a Jack Reacher book, which are amazing books, but Reacher can kick anybody's ass at any time, right? He can take on like seven people at a time and kick their ass, right? And all that. And I have never had that experience in my life of being able to kick seven people's asses. Six I could do, but when it gets to seven, I'm out. So there's a certain point where it feels like that's not, most people cannot do those things. So in some ways it's more interesting to see the person who is just the regular person. And I think to some extent we probably all have thought, what would happen if I was forced into this situation where I was fighting for my life, or I was accused of a crime that I didn't commit, or someone was coming after me, or I had to solve a crime, but I didn't have anything to fall back on besides my own brain, the knife in the kitchen drawer, or the lamp that I can hit someone over the head with. I don't have a gun. I don't know martial arts. I don't have any special skills like that. What's it like if someone with those limited abilities, and like most people, finds themselves in over their heads and has to figure out a way out of it? So to me, that's an intriguing scenario to explore, and it's the one that I've pretty much explored in all my books.
It's very relatable.
Yeah, Queen Latifah can kick six, seven people's ass. You can't? Come on.
I haven't. I guess you're talking about the Equalizer. Yeah. I haven't seen that yet. I know she's in the remake there. I mean, I know when Denzel did it in the movies, he could do it.
And yeah. Well, they don't really show her doing it. She just walks in the room and it goes silent, and then you see her face and she's walking out and everyone's laying on the floor. So it's not like that.
Hey, I got to tell you, I would not mess with Queen Latifah.
I wouldn't.
I just would not.
No.
In real life or on TV.
No,
so,
exactly. But I don't think she actually has to do it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there would be stunt people involved to some extent.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That's. So you're telling the story from three points of view then.
Yeah, so the point of view of the professor, the point of view of the student who had their manuscript stolen, who comes back saying, hey, what the heck are you doing, dude? And the point of view of another student who is, in some ways, that student, her name is Rebecca, is the more normal character in the book. She's more like the every person who's observing what's going on. And she finds herself playing a larger role in the story and the unraveling of the mystery than she would have expected, or even that I expected when I started writing the book. But yeah, so those three points of view there.
Mm. So So these characters then, I'm just wondering if you, when you're writing their script, so to speak, or what they're thinking and saying and doing, so do you put yourself into that person? Do you kind of pretend you're that person and figure what you would do? Or does this come from somewhere else?
I think it is like pretending to be that person. In a way, it's like the way an actor plays a character. And in order for an actor to play a character, they might have to imagine a backstory for that character. They might have to think about, oh, you know, this character, you know, came from a nice home or came from a rotten home or, you know, blah, 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 blah. In the same way, I think writers do that when we get into other characters' heads. We think about who these people are. We think about what is motivating them, what their backstory is, how they ended up in this place, even if that's not stuff that goes into the book. And a lot of it may not go into the book. But I think that's just a way for a writer to get an entry point to a character, to just understand a little bit about them and who they are. And that's part of the fun of writing, and writing from multiple points of view like that, is saying, I can pretend to be someone else. I can pretend to be a younger person. I can pretend to be an older person. I can pretend to be a killer. I can pretend to be whatever. And you know, it's a safe, fun way to get inside someone else's skin for a while.
Do you hear your characters? Can you hear their voices? I mean, I know I hear voices in my head when I write, but I just wonder if you have an inner monologue, or if you're, you know, translating more images and symbols when you write.
No, I definitely hear them. I think it's essential for me, and I'm sure every writer is a little different, and different writers have different ways of going about it. Like you're saying, some people may be more visual, and they may be seeing things more vividly, and some writers may be hearing things more vividly. But for me, it's hearing. It's imagining the sound and the rhythms of people's voices. In regular life, when I know people, talk to people, listen to people, I note what they sound like and the rhythms of their voices, and the little things that they do with their voice or their hand gestures or things like that, which I think can tell you a lot about a person's personality. I mean, in many ways, someone's voice and someone's gestures are some of the most prominent things that we know about people, obviously, aside from what they look like. And so I've always found myself paying attention to those things a lot. When I was a kid, I can remember, you know, if adults were talking, like when I was a kid, there was a woman who lived across the street from us. And she was this woman, she was a little older than my parents, and my parents were old. But she knew everything that was going on in the neighborhood. She knew everybody's business in the neighborhood. And so she would talk to my mom or my dad about it. And I can just remember listening to her talk and listening to these stories she was telling about other people. And that was so fascinating, just to listen to people. I didn't like to talk to people, but I liked to listen to people and eavesdrop on people from when I was very young. So anyway, I think that's something that some writers do. You listen to the rhythms of speech, and then that's a way to understand who people are and then put them in the book that way.
How far do you go? Like when you're in one of the characters, I'm thinking this would be a perfect book. You know, Dave, you could write this one. This is about a writer who's a professor who writes about taking a student who thinks he's dead and putting it out. And then he writes about it. And this is the whole story. Maybe you've got the whole story from a student you had. Too confusing.
Maybe now I have to write the story of the professor who wrote the book about the person stealing the book from the student. Is that what you're saying? Like, I will infinitely be writing books about the,
Yeah, but think about it. It could be a series.
A series of like Russian nesting dolls,
Wow.
Or like the mirror, you know, the infinite regression of the
You read my mind. Wow.
I'll drive myself crazy, but yes, well, I can try to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what happens to you, right? It's about the art.
That's true.
Well, now, and one thing I notice is this is considered a suspenseful, provocative novel about sexual harassment that still runs rampant in academia. So if is that kind of a point you wanted to put in this book? Was this something that you felt was important?
Yeah, it was. I had tried to write this book a couple of other times and couldn't quite get the idea off the ground. I wanted to write a story about, and again, it's just because I'm in this world, I wanted to write about a creative writing professor and a creative writing professor who had some sort of mentorship or something with a student, and there was a stolen manuscript. I had those ideas, but it never quite got off the ground until I thought about this, adding the element of the sexual harassment on college campuses. And the reason I wanted to do that is that I've seen that as a student, I've seen that as a faculty member, I've seen that. And it hasn't gone away just because we have Me Too. I mean, it's people are more aware of it, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. And it's an incredibly toxic and harmful thing that happens to a community when someone abuses their power in that way. And so that was just an element that I think brought the story to another level, or I certainly hope it did, that the book I hope is entertaining and page turning, but it's also trying to say something about an important issue as well.
Do you have to be careful about how you approach a subject like that with these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little tricky, and I'm not complaining about this. I think it's a little tricky for a man to write about it because it's not an issue that affects men. It's an issue that largely has affected women over the years. I hope that because I've had the experience of seeing it in academia, and I've been in academia, that I have some credibility to talk about it. I don't have the experience of being harassed in that way. And I'm not writing from the point of view. I mean, I'm writing from the point of view of one character who experienced that. But more than anything, I'm just trying to say this is something that is toxic for an entire community. Obviously, the person who is harassed suffers more than anyone else, but it ripples through a community. It creates a lot of distrust, a lot of suspicion, and a lot of trouble for everybody.
Where did writing start for you? Like, when did you start getting the bug to write stuff?
You know, I think I always had it because I always read, and I grew up in a house, fortunately, where my parents read all the time. So reading was just part of life. And I remember writing some stories when I was a kid, but I wasn't one of those people who, sometimes you hear these writers who are like, oh, as soon as I could write, I was writing story after story. And I was not like that. But I can remember as I got older, you know, when I got into high school and got into college, I started to think this could be a profession that these books that I read and that I read in school, there's actually someone on the other end who wrote them. And they're not all dead because, you know, sometimes it can feel like all these writers who were reading are these dead people or these people who were living in Paris or whatever, or New York City. And I was living in the middle of the country. And all of those places seem very far away. But occasionally we would read a book by a writer who was alive. And it would be someone who, you know, lived in the middle of the country. Like, I remember reading The Outsiders in eighth grade. And, you know, here was this writer. I mean, not obviously there was the fact that she wrote when she was very young. But it was also that she was from Oklahoma and she was writing this book about Oklahoma. And it was just like, oh, so she's almost just like a regular person who did this, right? Not like she didn't have to be off running with the bulls to write this book. You know, she wrote about probably stuff she saw growing up. And so I just started to think about that more as I got older and started to think maybe this could be a profession that I would try. And besides, I wasn't good at anything else, so I had to do something.
So when you can't do anything, you write? Is that kind of the...
Yeah, no. When you can't do anything, you teach. That's what
yeah, that's...
I kid. Forgive me, fellow teachers.
Yeah.
No, I think that you probably anybody who writes understands that. I think to some extent, a lot of writers go through it where we almost hope something else will present itself to us. You know, like, I wish I could just be an accountant. I wish I could just do that, right? Because this other thing is going to be hard and uncertain and insecure and difficult. But at a certain point, I think people who are really writers realize this is the thing I have to do and there's not much choice and I might as well just, sit down and start doing it. And I'm going to be terrible at it for a long time, maybe forever, but, I'm not going to get any better unless I try.
I wonder, but what was it that, lit the fire for you to actually think you could have something published? You know, like there's people that read a lot and can even write and be into, you know, literature and reading and all that stuff. But to actually put your thoughts down or put down some sort of a story and then send it in to be published or put it out there so other people can read it, it's kind of an exposure of some of your feelings and thoughts and a story you created. So in a way, that makes you kind of vulnerable. I just wonder, was there something that gave you that, I call it courage, to actually do that?
Gosh, I think it was just that I was so hungry and determined to do it. And that I do think that, and I look back on this and I think, I seem incredibly stupid and naive to have thought this, but I look back on it and I thought when I started writing, I remember in college, so the summer between my junior and my senior year of college, I went home for the summer and I can very clearly remember one day I was there in my bedroom, you know, in my parents' house, and it just, this realization just landed on me, this is my last year of school. Like, I've been in school since I was 5, and now I'm 21, and this is it. Come May, I'm out. I'm off the payroll. Like, I have to go do something with my life. And I had no idea what to do. And I thought, well, maybe I should try to be a writer. And I really did think early on at that point, I thought, well, okay, I want to be a writer. I'm going to start writing some short stories and I'll send them to magazines and they'll get published. I thought like it was that easy. I don't know why I idiotically thought that I would just start sending my stories out and they would get published. Maybe it's just that by the time I figured out how hard it was and how many rejections were going to come in, I was in it and I couldn't back out at that point. But maybe it was a combination of naivete, desperation, hunger to do something, and I didn't have that hunger to do anything else in my life, right? There was no other profession that was calling out to me, so I just went for it.
You didn't want to do the McDonald's drive-thru, or?
Well, I mean, I have had plenty of jobs like that, I will say. So I know what that's like, too. And I guess I kind of thought, you might be working at the McDonald's drive-through and writing your short story on the side. You might even be publishing short stories or even books and still working at the McDonald's drive-through. Because I realized pretty quickly you're not going to get paid a lot of money for doing this, at least certainly not when you're starting out.
Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder that, I wonder if that would make a person be even more hungry in a way. So like, you know, when you're out and you realize that you're not making a whole lot of money with your first books and your writing, you have to really want to keep writing in order to keep doing it, right? Because you're still doing another job and you're still, or you're living with your parents, you know, in your case. I wonder, so you have to keep wanting to write. Do you know what I'm saying? Because it's, in a way, it's kind of a suffering.
Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's why I say I don't think anybody who really doesn't want to do it would continue to do it, because it takes so much time. Most writers don't publish until they're, I mean, just like writers publishing a first book. For most writers, that's probably getting into their 30s or their 40s or their 50s. It takes a long time to get there. There's no entry-level job as a writer. You can't come out of school and have someone say, well, yeah, come on into this office and write from 9 to 5 and we'll give you a salary and benefits, right? It's a long road to get published. It's all that time while you're trying to get published. People say to you, oh, well, what are you doing? And you say, oh, well, I'm a writer. And they say, oh, well, have you published anything? And you have to say, well, no. And then you ask yourself, well, am I really a writer if I haven't published anything? Because we live in a results-oriented, bottom-line kind of society. So, like, if someone said, like, if I met somebody at a cocktail party and, you know, I was like, what do you do? And the person said, well, I'm a doctor. And I said, oh, well, you know, like, where do you work? What do you do? And they said, well, I don't actually practice medicine. I mean, I'm a doctor.
I'm a waiter.
I mean, I hope to be a doctor. You know, like, so, like, you know, if I understand people's skepticism about a career if you haven't actually, you don't have a tangible thing to show from the career. But that's the lot of being a writer, is that there will be many years where you haven't published anything, or you've published, you know, one short story that you didn't even get paid for. And writers have to have something that gets them through that time where they say, yeah, I can get through this, to the point where maybe there will be a tangible result, a book on the shelf or whatever that I can show somebody.
Yeah. 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 I have to work as a male prostitute.
Well, you know, that's probably working a lot at night. So during the day, you have time to write.
Well, yeah. And, you know, it's important that you have your writing time. If you're teaching in the day 5 days a week, and you've also got things to work out around your work, you know, homework, as no pun intended. But when you're doing that, how do you decide when you're going to write, and how do you set up a time? Are you able to just kind of go, okay, well, Saturday I've got from 11 till 3, so I'll write then? And are you able to sit down and actually write and be productive, or do you have to wait till the mood hits?
I try to, because of the teaching schedule, I try to work it out so that when it's time to write the first draft of a book, that time falls when I have a break from school. So our holiday break between semesters is 6 weeks. So I try to work it out so that I've made the outline and done all that stuff, all that pre-writing work leading up to the break. And then when it gets to be the break, I don't have anything else to do but write as much of the first draft as I can. And so that helps, because then there's nothing else distracting me. And it's a great excuse over the holidays when you go see your family and they say, well, don't you want to spend time with us? Sorry, I've got a deadline. I can't spend time with you at Christmas.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Just too busy.
I hope they don't listen.
Oh, I don't care. So you know, I try to do it that way. But when I am writing during the time when I'm teaching, then the schedule is a little less regular because other stuff gets in the way. And even a writer who didn't have a job, stuff gets in the way. I mean, life always is getting in the way. You know, if somebody has kids or they have a sick parent or, you know, you have to go to the bank, you have to do whatever. There's always stuff. You have to go to the bank and get a loan because you're a writer and you need money and you're borrowing money against your house or whatever you're doing. But really, you know, like there's life is always going to get in the way. So I think that I'm pretty good at compartmentalizing and being able to say, yes, this is, you know, I've got to set aside this little bit of time to get a certain amount of writing done. Most writers have to be able to do that because, like I said, even if you don't have a day job, there's something that's coming along and demanding your time, and you have to be able to juggle all those things.
Well, I think to get published, you know, like in the beginning, you have to write, you know, it's probably easier isn't the right word for it, but you have to write, you know, something competent, a competent genre novel. But to get to the level where you're at, you have to do something beyond that. And I'm just wondering if you feel you have a unique ingredient that has brought you to the level that you're at.
Are you talking about something in the writing or something about in my personality makeup or
anything, both? Yeah.
Or are you talking about my good looks?
Which that, is well, that, what has gotten absolutely.
You this far.
Sleeping with the publisher. I don't know.
Now. Didn't you read my book? You're not supposed to do those
nope.
things.
Oh.
Yeah.
Slap your hand, Al.
if you're talking about the writing itself, I mean, I think that I've done a good job over the years, I think, of writing well about characters. I think good characters are the lifeblood of good stories. And I think I've managed to create good characters and to write stories about characters who have relationships and contact with people and the complications of those relationships. The kind of books that I write, like we said earlier, are about regular people, so they're not about spies and all that. It's not like, you know, a detective novel where it's like the lone wolf detective going out there and solving the crime with people who they don't really know that well. In my books, it's people who are connected to each other in some way. So there are undercurrents in those relationships, family resentments, family secrets, relationship problems, on and on. I think I've done a good job of presenting those relationships and those characters in that way. I think maybe that's a thing that's appealing about my books. You'd have to go out and ask my 5 billion readers to really find out what's going on, of course.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of if it's something about my own makeup, I think it's just I am, you know, I was fortunate to, like I said, my parents read a lot when I was growing up. I was also fortunate to grow up I grew up in Cincinnati. I grew up on the west side of Cincinnati, which is the more blue collar side of Cincinnati. And, you know, I grew up in an environment that was, and I grew up Catholic. So there was a lot of, you know, there was a certain toughness and stubbornness in that environment that I think we all had to acquire to survive, right? Being around a lot of working class people, being in an abusive Catholic environment, you know, it was like there was a certain toughness required of us. And I think that, and that just stubbornness, that stubborn determination to not quit, came to me from my environment and from my family. And that has kept me going for a long time. There's something to be said for stubbornness and determination more than anything else.
Absolutely.
And for Catholics.
Yeah, well, don't get me started.
So now what do you think about the world today? You know, we have so much interaction with people that we don't know, you know, like the, social media and stuff. So and reviews and Amazon and all that stuff. So people can come along and see a book of yours and say, well, you know, David couldn't write if his life depended on it. And they can say all sorts of stuff. How do you deal with the interactions of social media?
And that's just my mother's review. The one saying I couldn't write this in my life. Imagine what strangers say. It's an interesting thing. Part of it is that, I guess when I published my first books, it was right. My first book came out in 2008. So it was right on the brink of social media just becoming a thing. I mean, Facebook was around then, but for those first few books, there wasn't even that much promotion done on social media for those books. I mean, I posted about them, but it wasn't a regular thing. And I don't think there were a ton of authors doing that. Goodreads wasn't there. Amazon was there, but I don't know that we quite even back then were giving the same weight to the Amazon reviews and the stars and the algorithm and all that stuff. So I've been there for a little bit of the transition to this growing and growing and growing and growing. Like I can remember about 5 years ago having a meeting at my publisher, and maybe it was like 6 years ago or something, and Instagram came up. And I'm putting it in air quotes, my team, they were like, Instagram, I wouldn't really worry about that much. And then it was just like 6 months later, it was like, you better be on Instagram because Instagram's exploding with books. So it's like, it's all changing very rapidly. I would like to think, maybe I'm just telling myself this, it makes it easier to communicate with people about what you're doing. It makes it easier to say to people, hey, the book is out on Tuesday. Hey, you know, the book is on sale for $1.99 today. Hey, I'm doing a book signing in Dubuque tomorrow night. Hey, make sure you leave a review, whatever. I'd like to think that that's true, and we all tell ourselves that that's true. I don't know if it's true, but we are telling ourselves that that's true. So I'd like to think those are the positive things. And then occasionally, you know, you have direct communication with readers. Who can write to you and say, hey, the book is great. I love your books. I love whatever. Sometimes people write and say, did you know that on page 299, there's a comma missing?
Yeah.
You get that too.
Yeah.
But I think there's a downside to it, which is that as with many things in our world, we tend to play to social media now. We tend to conflate the social media world with the real world. So if Agnes from Boise writes a review on Goodreads that she didn't like your book, people get in a tizzy. Oh, no. Like, you know, especially if it's one of the first reviews that goes up on Goodreads or Amazon, it's like, oh, no, Agnes took you down. Agnes from Dubuque took you down, right? What are we going to do? And it's like, you know, Agnes is just like one person out of 320 million people in this country. Let's not give Agnes too much power. So upsides and downsides, but nevertheless, it's here to stay. And I think writers have to just keep it in perspective that it's not necessarily the real world. Don't become too obsessed with it. Don't let your self-esteem rise and fall based on what, people are saying in those places, because like I said, it's not the real world.
Yeah. And you know, and I always just right back to Agnes. Look, Agnes, don't tell me how to write. I don't go to your job and slap the sailor's cock out of your mouth. So
you know.
Exactly. You know. I agree. Or I wanted to say, write your own damn book, Agnes. Yes. You know, leave me alone.
That's right.
I mean, you know, Hemingway didn't have to put up with that.
Yeah.
You know, people had, Larry O'Connor didn't have people writing and saying, you know, stuff. So anyway.
Yeah. Just look, you know, Agnes.
Yeah.
Just stick to your lane, right?
Right.
Now, it's interesting that you said how you like to kind of put things in compartments in your mind. So in your life, when things are going crazy, and that could be maybe outside things like COVID, for instance, or it could be, you know, some sort of shooting in your neighborhood or something's going on. So there's this outside stress. Does that stop you or hinder you from writing, or do you take that and put it into your writing?
Certainly that real life provides, real life gets in the way and provides obstacles. I mean, I remember when the pandemic was starting, that was when I was starting to write Kill All Your Darlings. And I can remember I had to tear myself away from the news because that was the time where every day there was more news coming and more information coming, and we could all have just sat there hitting refresh on our computers to see more news coming in or whatever. And I had to consciously tear myself away from that. There are always these crises happening in life, sick parents, you know, whatever, stuff is always going on. Do I think it creeps into my writing in some way? No doubt it does. I mean, no doubt. The anxieties and the fears that we all have seep into the books, even if we're not directly writing about them. I think those things come in, and in some ways, I think that makes writing better. If I'm feeling a certain way, if I'm grappling with something, and it's vivid and real to me, and somehow I work that into a story, even if it's not taking it on directly. If that is a real thing to me or a real thing to someone I care about, then it's probably going to make the story better. So that stuff comes in.
Do you have a way to recharge in between books, or do you just move on to the next thing?
I like taking a little bit of downtime. I mean, usually I'll read more, you know, in between, just because it's a little harder to find time to read. I mean, I read every day, but if I'm busy and the day is full, then you're talking about like reading, you know, 5 pages before I fall asleep at night, you know, at those times. But between books, when there's a little more time, yeah, I like to read a lot like that. I think that's a great time to read and see what other people are doing, to just kind of go back to the drawing board and see, you know, what is someone else doing with the story, or just to read stories that are very different than my own, or writers who are very different than I am, just to see what else is out there. I think it would be boring to read the same book all the time. So reading is always a thing to help with the escape. And obviously, you know, watching TV shows, movies, all those things are nice ways to recharge the batteries, but to still be seeing stories and thinking about stories, and exploring different ways to tell stories. You know, why does this story that I'm reading work? And could I take something away from it? Why does this TV show work, or why does it not work, or whatever? That's always stuff I like to do.
Do you read anything or have any influences that might be surprising to fans?
Oh, surprising? Hmm. Well, when I look back on my childhood, you know, the books that I read and fell in love with when I was young, and maybe this is just something about childhood, it was a lot of fantasy kind of stuff. Like, I loved The Hobbit. I remember reading The Hobbit when I was a kid and just being so – I remember, I think I was homesick from school one day and picked up The Hobbit and just like – practically read the whole thing in one day, and just loving that. And I love King Arthur stories and like King Arthur and his knights and that. Yeah. So that, and I've never really written anything like that. And I don't think my imagination runs to stuff like that, even though to this day I will still read fantasy, sometimes, but that, like, that was stuff that made me want to write, that made me fascinated by stories and the way a story could transport you to a different place, because that's what those stories we're doing. And maybe that's just part of childhood, that kids are fed a diet of, you know, fairy tales and adventure stories and things. You know, kids aren't necessarily reading gritty realism, although maybe now there's more and more of that. I don't know, because there's more sophisticated stuff for kids now. I don't know.
Yeah.
So what do you think your most important book is?
The most important?
To you. Like when you
when
you look back at all the work you've done, and you kind of go, what's your favorite, maybe, or thing you, the book that you are most proud of?
It's tough to say, because I have these different associations with them, which are not necessarily about the quality of the book, which I can't really see objectively. It's very difficult for me to know objectively what is the quote unquote best book. But I just have associations with the books. Like, for instance, you know, my first book that was published, which was published by a small press, like, obviously that has a very fond place in my heart, because it was my first book. And because once I published that book, or once that book was coming out, I literally was able to say, okay, you will not die without publishing a book. This is happening. Check that off the bucket list. You're publishing a book. You will not die without publishing a book. So, like, things like that. Cemetery Girl was the first one that was published in New York. And so, you know, so that was also a significant step up and significant step forward. So that's one that stands out because of that. But I look back at the books, and I can see things about all of them that I'm proud of, that make them stand out. But a lot of them are associations with what was going on in my life as I was writing the book, that don't necessarily have anything to do with the reader's experience of reading the book, as far as I can tell.
So you write a book each time you murder someone.
Well, I frequently want to murder people. I will say that I have not, to the best of your knowledge, I haven't done it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, we have to keep that secret. We won't tell anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No, I always say this. I say people who write crime and horror and mystery and thrillers and that stuff, they're very normal people, because they work it all out in the book. I mean, if you're thinking of killing somebody, you just kill them in the book. If you have a dark thought, you just put it in the book, and then, you know, it's like going to therapy. You've worked it out, and then you don't bring it into your real life so much.
Hmm. Well,
at least that's what I'm telling myself.
Well, that's what you know. Yeah, you're in denial, but
I'm in denial. And I don't want to go to therapy, so I'm telling myself that the book is the therapy.
Yeah. Well, I wonder. So when you are out at the supermarket, or you're driving in the road, and someone cuts you off, and there's someone that does something that's quite rude to you, do you kill that character? Like, do you take that person and make them a character in the book, and give them a rough life?
I have certainly based characters on people I don't like, and written unflattering portraits of them in books. But it's not usually the person who cuts me off in traffic, because that's impersonal. Like, I'm never going to see that person again. That's just, you know, that's just kind of impersonal rudeness to someone. I'm talking about killing people who I know well. In the books, that's where I dispatch the people who have been bothering me for years.
Mm. Yeah. So your mother? No.
Not her. Not
She's
her
the one cutting you off on traffic.
Well, thank God she doesn't drive anymore. She gave birth to me, so I kind of have her on a pedestal.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you know. And
I mean, if you saw my dad, I mean, she really, you know. To give birth to me. So anyway.
Yeah, she had to go through a lot.
He took one for the team.
Yeah. Do you have a way that you want people to come find you? Do you give out your street address, phone number, or do you have a website?
Isn't everybody's street address public knowledge anyway? Like, anybody could show
just
up.
Just about.
I would prefer that they not come to my house. I would prefer that they go to my website, which is davidbellnovels.com, or they can find me on social media. I am on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and all of those are also David Bell at David Bell Novels. And I'm on Goodreads. If you want to see me fight Agnes from Boise on Goodreads, I'm on there too.
That'd take her out, boy, I'll tell you. Do you have like Tinder, Grindr, or any of those things too?
I do, but I don't use my real name.
Oh, of course not. You're Agnes.
See, my wife isn't home, so I can say that. But no, I don't. I don't even want to know what those things are about. Like, that's too much for me. I can't even deal with that. That's what my students teach me about that stuff, but it's not for me.
We'll have everything connected to ours as well, so people listening can go one click and stuff like that. Do you like the self-publishing world? Do you like the way people can just, you know, Joe Blow down the road can just go, well, I'm going to write a book, and they write it and they just send it to Amazon, stick it on, and it's badly written, and, you know, they drew the cover themselves and stuff. Do you look at that, or do you think that brings the standard down of writers?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. I used to be, you know, back, you know, like 15 years ago, before Amazon really had their thing, people had to pay a lot of money to get self-published. Mm. Like those old places, like what were they called? Like Ex Libris, and yeah, there were some old ones that Author Tree was that one. I don't remember what these were. There were some old ones where, I mean, like you had to shell out a lot of money to get published, and then there was nowhere for the book to be sold. So like you were just paying a lot of money to have 5,000 copies of a book in your garage, right? I think now it's, you know, with the Amazon stuff and probably other outlets, you know, I guess I say, on the one hand, it's eroded the standard a little bit, because now everywhere you go, you meet someone who's like, oh yeah, my cousin's an author, you know, my hairdresser sister is a poet, you know, whatever. And I think the same is true in other art forms, like, you know, music. It's like anybody can make an album. I'm putting it in air quotes. You can't see it. Anybody can make an album. Anybody can do that now. You know, so there's that. I mean, the small D Democrat part of me, you know, like, why not? You know, why not? If somebody can go out and make an independent movie with their credit card and just make a movie, why shouldn't somebody be able to do that with books? And I think that could be an outlet, for, you know, if someone can't find a publisher, if you're an established author and you write something that doesn't quite fit anywhere, if you just want to, you know, take a flyer and see what that's like, you know, it's a viable option. I like the idea that authors have more options in that way than they used to. There are fewer options in terms of bookstores and things like that, which is also disappointing. But, you know, authors have some options about getting their work out. Whether anybody ends up reading it, I have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's one of those things. It's just because it also puts a lot of competition your way, right? I mean, instead of just having the publishers putting out books, there's like 1,000 new ones every day. And so I would think that it would take away. It's harder to get the attention, right, of the customer.
It's harder to get the attention, and really, I think the big thing is the price of the books that someone can publish on Amazon, or some publishers, they'll just sell their eBooks for 99 cents or $1.99 or whatever, and then if you're published with a big five publisher, your ebook is being sold for $8.99 to $12.99 or whatever. And constantly we hear, oh, well, I'm not going to buy that because it's too expensive, because it's $9.99 or $12.99 or whatever. And people are just reading the 99 cent or the $1.99 ebook or the book that goes on sale. I mean, occasionally my books will, you know, you'll have the book bub special or whatever, where something's for sale. I think that's really the big thing, is it's in a way it's devalued the cost of books, that people think a book should be 99 cents. And they act like if I have to pay $10 for a book or $15 for a book, it's outrageous. Maybe that's the biggest problem right there.
Okay, so now everybody in L.A. wants to know what David Bell, something that people don't know about you that you're going to let us know.
Well, I like to walk in the cemetery by my house in the morning. And as I walk through the cemetery, I look at the headstones, And I calculate how old the person was when they died. And so it's a little math exercise to keep my brain sharp. But really what I'm thinking is I'm comparing my age to the age of that person who died. And if the person lived a nice long life, like, you know, someone who's over, lived to be over 80 or whatever, I take comfort in that. And then when I see someone who is my age or just a few years older than I am, I feel the cold, icy grip of care seizing me. So that's what I do in the morning.
Well, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
You know, watch the Addams Family and go for a walk.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's right. What I do. Boy, I'll tell you.
It's quiet and peaceful in the cemetery in the morning. It's usually I'm there. There are a couple of grave diggers there getting ready for the day's work. And there are always the same two widowers are there visiting their wives' graves. I noticed that I rarely see women visiting graves. I always see men visiting graves, and I don't know why that is. I don't know if the women are happy that the men have died and they don't want to come to the cemetery. Because you would figure there would be more women at the cemetery because men die sooner, right? There are more widows than widowers, I would imagine.
No,
these are the things I think
about.
Well,
you want me? I can let you in on a secret.
What's that?
They're
glad that their husbands are dead?
No, it's a big hookup place. For guys.
Oh, I see.
That's why they're not there visiting a grave. They're meeting. I'll meet you at this grave. Okay. Come on, it's a hookup spot. Boy.
Oh, okay. See, I've always, you know, my dad, before he died, he was in a nursing home for the last 6 months of his life. And I've heard this before, that in senior communities like that or nursing homes, there are so many more women than men. And it was true when my dad was in the nursing home. On his floor, there were maybe like 6 or 7 men and 50 women, because the men were all dead by then, you know. So,
Wow, I'm not touching that one.
So we will be hot properties when we're like 85 years old and confined to a wheelchair. That's when you come into your prime.
Well, yeah, we've learned a lot, and I can't tell you, you know, it's been a very interesting show, and. God, you know, David Bell likes to eavesdrop, so watch out. Don't go sitting in the coffee shop. You see him, he's going to write about you.
Well, I tell my students that if you're a writer, you're allowed to eavesdrop.
Yes.
It's rude if you're not a writer, but if you're a writer, you're allowed to do that because it's rude.
Yeah, so if you're not a writer, just publish a 2-page thing on Amazon and you're a writer.
Yeah.
There we have it. You heard it from the best. Our guest, David Bell, his new book, Kill All Your Darlings, is out now. Thank you for being here, Dave.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate
it. Thanks, David.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.